happy Wednesday, May the 13th, 2026, and a happy birthday to Diane Newman, the head of programming for us and our show and all that she does. She is the glue that keeps this all together for us each and every day. And we appreciate same. And hopefully she can have an uninterrupted day and celebrate her birthday today. Gave her a little shout out yesterday on the phone and said I didn't want to interrupt her day today. So, but anyway, happy birthday to Di. We got a great show lined up for you today. We will visit with Stephanie Turner, Senior Vice President of Convention Sales and Strategies for New Orleans and Company. And we will talk about convention sales. We'll talk about those strategies. We'll talk about meetings headed this way, the receiving of awards by the Convention Center and others, as well as we'll talk about the Omni Convention Center Headquarters Hotel and a whole lot more. And I remind you that we are really in the competition business. And as was just pointed out at top of the hour news by Dave Cohen, relative to Canadian visitors, thing of a big concern, trying to reestablish that. Some ill feelings between comments made by President Donald Trump and the Canadians. The Canadian folks felt slighted, felt disrespected by saying that they would be the 51st state. I can totally understand their feelings. They take a lot of pride in their country. I certainly can't fault them for that. But they really believe, like, why should we reward the United States with our travel dollars? We understand the importance of the relationship that we have with the United States, but what we don't understand is why we need to be treated in a certain fashion. The lieutenant governor called everyone out on this issue a long time ago and said that it was going to be a big issue, big problem. But it highlights how competitive this business is. And how you have to manage and massage it very carefully. Because if you lose the trust of countries that send a lot of folks over here traveling to see the United States to satisfy a curiosity, one that's been piqued in so many different ways, that you can lose it very quickly. And you have to work three times as hard to get it back. So we'll talk not about that, but we'll talk a lot about this competition that's out there and why it's so important that we stay out in front of these issues. We'll visit with Michael Heck at 11 o'clock, President and CEO of GNO Inc. We've got a number of talking points. And we'll also visit with Jasmine Brown de Roussel, Chief External Affairs Officer for GNO Inc., as well as Manish Bhatt, Vice President of State Tax Policy for the Tax Foundation. There is a constitutional amendment number 4. Which will allow parishes to choose to eliminate or reduce Louisiana's inventory tax. As the tax collector in my former role, I often said that there were two taxes that I thought were incredibly stupid. One, the occupational license tax, being a percentage of gross sales, makes no sense. To me, what made sense is that a jurisdiction should know about the businesses that are located within the territorial boundaries of their jurisdiction. But it should be a flat fee, not percentage of gross sales. And inventory taxes. At the end of the year, you basically go in and see everything you have on the shelves and you're taxed on it. It's absolutely crazy. It doesn't make sense. Local governments, for a whole host of reasons, have become very much relying on it. There are some parishes that will get hurt a lot more. This seems to be a compromise approach, and we'll talk about that. Michael Austin, Project 21 Ambassador at the National Center for Public Policy Research and Professor of Economics at Washburn University, right there in Topeka, Kansas. We're going to talk about President Donald Trump's in Beijing, meeting with Chinese President Xi Jinping, as to what the two men hope to accomplish here. What have they let us to believe will be discussed, and what truly are the takeaways for this meeting? First time in 9 years, I believe. The last time he was there is when he was in office the first time around, early onset. First time that president's been there in 9 years, and so we will talk about that as well. The Louisiana State Legislature met last evening and have come out crafting a redistricting policy proposal that will go back to one minority-majority district. There was no doubt that the second district, clearly, the evidence reveals that the motivation, the intent of all the parties involved was to create a second minority-majority district. As a result of the Calais case ruled upon by the United States Supreme Court, race cannot be the predominant issue in creating a district, or any part of the issue, quite frankly. And we have seen a series of cases that have been moving in this direction for quite a long time. What's interesting to me is how everybody is so surprised about this. It's amazing to me that a case has not been reviewed by the U.S. Supreme Court on this particular issue for a while. Everyone goes to the Voting Rights Act. The Voting Rights Act was more about removing the impediments from voting, not guaranteeing an outcome of an election. And in fact, there's language there that seems to imply, and it's kind of direct language, actually, that we're not about to try to achieve proportionality in the outcomes of elections. This was about removing these barriers that were silly, they were stupid, they were racist, they were designed to try to systematically diminish the amount of minority voters that would be able to vote on any given election. That's what the Voting Rights Act was put in place to do, to remove those barriers, to make sure that they were no longer there, that everybody adhered to the same qualifications that were necessary to be able to vote. Some of these things were cuckoo, didn't make any sense. We knew what the intentions were at that time. Afterwards, we knew all through the process. I don't think there's anybody out there saying that they didn't. It's just kind of interesting that where we find ourselves in this country of talking about, you know, going back in time, that we're trying to eliminate the possibility. And I don't really quite understand this argument. I don't know how you can embrace racism by law in order to deal with racism by law, where you can give preference by law, which is the very nature of racism, and expect to do away with racism. It doesn't quite work that way. And then as you divide up through the country into states, into locales, into communities, it gets even stickier as to how you're going to ultimately achieve these things as an outcome. The governor said on 60 Minutes the other night, and I think he was right when he said, and they were questioning as to why would you cancel the election, when he simply went straight to the point, and I think he's right. Well, the U.S. Supreme Court said that that district was unconstitutional. So why would I want to elect someone to an unconstitutional district? It will be challenged and it will go away and we'll have to go through this whole thing again. Why not just address it now? The follow-up question was, well, there were 4,800 votes that were cast. Okay. There are votes cast all the time when candidates drop out. And we just simply discard those votes. But they're going to get a chance. Everyone will get a chance to vote in whatever the districts are going to look like ultimately once they go through this whole process in the fall. But I can't understand any argument to suggest that we should move forward in electing someone to an unconstitutional district. The evidence is clear. In fact, most of the folks are not even attacking the evidence at all, because the record speaks for itself. as to what the motivation and what the intent was in the creation of the second district. I guess the big concern was is that theoretically, because of the language in Calais, we could question whether or not the other district, which is held by Troy Carter, would be a problem as well. And I don't know how we got to the maintenance of that one district. It was what I hoped that they would do all along, is make it clear that the one district that was created, that everybody knew was going to ultimately be a problem if the Supreme Court ever ruled on this case, and it did, that it seems like, in my mind, this is the appropriate outcome. Now, you know what's interesting when we talk about the clerk and all of the situations there, and we talk about what not only Republican-dominated states as well as Democrat-dominated states have done over the last three decades as it relates to gerrymandering, as it relates to consolidation of government and everything else. We're talking about how this has racial overtones and this, that, and otherwise. But it's amazing how it only goes one way, right? So let's look at the situation with the clerk. I remember hearing ad nauseum from Democrats at one point in time that elections have consequences. Elections have consequences. And when elections lead to a supermajority of one party or the other, and that party decides to embark upon cost-saving measures and the revenues that are handed down, state-mandated cost and everything else, not that I like all of this, I'm just telling you this is how this works. Elections have consequences. And obviously, timing, you can draw and try to say that there's some type of intention one way or another. But one might say that the best way to show everyone that elections have consequences is to pick your timing. Maybe they're picking this timing to send a message. I don't know. But it's funny how we don't talk about how elections have consequences. And I would suspect that there's going to be a lot more consequences coming this way. The danger when you elect a series of individuals over a period of time that never deliver a quality product, an efficient government, one where they are good fiscal stewards of the monies within that city, you create a landscape, an environment that is ripe for elections having not only consequences, but serious consequences. And for some, even more than others. Some will eat plenty crow. Others, not as much. But this isn't anything new. And for anybody to say that this is unfair on the part of one party or the other, obviously doesn't study history. Because this happens all the time across this country. Let's just look to the states that gerrymandered and their state in a way where only one party is represented throughout the entire state. Only one. There's no shot for others to get elected. That was done with intentionality. Elections have consequences. They've held the majority in that state, Massachusetts, for example. This has been going on for decades. It's part of this whole thing that I talk about, saying this isn't about me and it's not about you. It's about them. It's about the perpetuation of the party. It's about the perpetuation of the vote count inside the Beltway. Plain and simple. We are just spectators because we are not getting involved enough as to what we want to see. The majority of the country is somewhere, you know, center right, center left. It's been that way for most of my adulthood. But why is it that the outcomes are not? Because they devised a system that minimizes center left and center right. Because it's not about us. And we often wonder why, when we are talking about, and the talking heads at the national level are talking about elections having consequences, why we end up with certain things the way they are. And for the first time, the fringes are pushing back big time on all of this. But we, those that fall in the middle, and that's kind of where I put myself, socially moderate, fiscally conservative, we're not pushing anywhere, collectively, collaboratively together. We're very disjointed. And it's just kind of the nature of being in the middle. I get it. But that's how this whole thing is set up. And I really think it's disingenuous when the players inside the Beltway want to go to the mic or go to the podium and start calling the other sides, and both sides guilty of this, all kinds of names, being racist, doing this, doing that. They've all done it themselves before. We can point to this every time. Give me a name, any name, and I'll go put a dossier together of exactly the same conduct at some point in time during their career. So for me, it's all just noise. I said it yesterday. This is performative, what's going on here. Let's go to the streets and push back. I said yesterday, too, that I had spoken to a number of Democrat lawyers about the Voting Rights Act and where we have ended up and the actual words in Section 2 and what they mean. And asked, how did we get to where we are? They all chuckled. It actually turned out being compromises and this and that, you know, amongst a whole lot of other people in order to placate folks having nothing to do with the law. And it's amazing that's how everybody viewed it. They won't say it publicly. They won't assign their name to it. But they recognize that's exactly what has happened. And it's just another example of a game that's being played here. Everyone would do well by ignoring the three-ring circus, by ignoring these performative acts that are being conducted by our elected officials right now. Right now, we have little or no money. We're teetering every day, and yet we are going to go and get involved in all kinds of litigation. And for the sake of the performance, we're going to eliminate an office that's held by a minority in order to punish the whole, to try and send a message to Baton Rouge about what they're doing with the consolidation. It's otherwise known as cutting off our nose to spite our face. Now, there's some political nuances that are there as to what's driving all of this, which is curious as well. Because is it really about race? It can't just simply be about race, right, if we are allowing all of these other political nuances to enter into the arena. again, that very nasty word, control, is there. We don't all come to the table with altruistic thoughts about how we want this to all work out. No, 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 no. We could only wish that it could be that simple. It's become a lot more complex. You see it with the two remaining congressional districts. You had one that actually supported this governor, minority, and you had another one who didn't. I guess they could play that game and try to punish somebody politically or not or otherwise. So I've chosen to just not pay very little attention to all these performative acts that are going on right now because they're really meaningless. They don't mean anything. They're just there to try and get your ire, to try and make you believe that there are people doing things that they haven't done themselves. They're misleading you. They're hypocrites. They've all done it. They've all done it. It's just this time it's not working to their benefit. Why? Goes back to their mantra of a couple elections ago. Elections have consequences. We'll be right back. Welcome back, folks. We are joined by Michael Austin, Project 21 ambassador at the National Center for Public Policy Research and professor of economics at Washburn University in Topeka, Kansas. Michael, welcome to the show.
Oh, it's great to be here, Newell. Thanks for having me.
So, Michael, we think about this meeting with President Xi Jinping from China, the first meeting I think that the president's had in 9 years. With Xi, obviously it has been talked about a lot, bannered about a lot as to what the expectations are and what outcomes that each may want to achieve. There's a thought process out there that it might not be very much at the end of the day. Your thoughts?
Yeah, those motivations are really important. I would kind of look at it and saying China wants access to America's market. And so President Trump's job is going to be making China pay the price of admission. Beijing's biggest economic motivation, I would say, is stability. They want predictable access to American consumers, investors, technology, business relationships, all while avoiding deeper trade pressure. And I think Trump's leverage is that China still needs the American market more than American workers need another one-sided relationship. And so I think the message will be relatively straightforward. If China wants access to the American economy, it has to deliver on real value to American workers, farmers, and manufacturers.
You know, what's interesting is that China wants stability, they want predictability, but the fact of the matter is, in my view, they don't deliver it, right? We never know exactly what rules of engagement that they're actually going to embark upon or otherwise what rules they're going to play by and which ones they're going to ignore.
I think that's completely fair. You know, China says they want to, you know, manage this relationship, but I think President Trump is absolutely right when he says he wants to rebalance it, because for years, Beijing has benefited from a system where America bought their goods, bought Chinese goods, China built their factories, and Washington, frankly, just looked the other way whenever the rules were bent or they weren't followed at all. And so Trump's economic agenda, I really do believe, flips that script by using tariffs. They'll use purchase commitments. They'll use market access, all of that as bargaining chips rather than, you know, historical precedent of just using those as diplomatic inconveniences. The White House has framed its China policy around rebalancing trade and putting American workers, farmers, and businesses first. And so this is not about starting a trade fight. I really think it's about ending a bad deal.
Yeah, I mean, no doubt. You have to go in, though, a little suspect, right? Recently, we just learned of this mayor in the outskirts of L.A. Delivering messaging from China on behalf of China from that podium, from that position of authority that she has. I find it very interesting that China is getting down to a very granular level as to how they are trying to influence the thought processes of Americans in our country.
I think that's a really good point. You know, this is, of course, a friendly summit, but at the very same time, you have to acknowledge that China views us as an enemy. And so what we need to do as Americans, and this is definitely what President Trump is trying to do, is he's trying to isolate what China wants and then use it to actually turn it to an interest for America. You know, so economically, for example, as I said before, China still wants a relationship where it can grow, it can export, it can advance, and that it can keep pressing its geopolitical claims without paying a price. I think Trump's best move is to offer that stability, but only for concrete behavior. And economically, that might mean more U.S. purchases. Politically, it might be less on espionage, you know, less coercion, more pressure on Iran, and, you know, less restraint towards Taiwan. You know, stability, I think, is valuable, but, you know, President Trump just has to make China earn it.
China, several years ago, embarked upon a bunch of different programs with some pretty nifty little names on these programs, but really it was about economic development and pumping in significant amounts of money into underdeveloped countries who ultimately learned that they were being used, that they were being leveraged and manipulated. And it seems as though their attitude towards allowing China to come in and invest in their countries is not as strong as it once was. Would you agree or disagree with that? And if so, if you agree, where do they go from here? Where do you think their next step is?
Well, I think a lot of, you know, countries that get these investments from China are realizing it comes with so many strings that it really doesn't benefit their country. It just benefits China, as opposed to, you know, a capitalist perspective where, you know, both parties can improve themselves and see a growth and well-being. But that is not what China promotes. And I think a lot of countries are now questioning whether they should turn back to the U.S. to try to, you know, build more of a free market type enterprise than more of a Marxist one. Additionally, when you look at, let's say, the American markets, I think something that Trump most certainly needs to look into is farmers and farm income in America. You know, China has a huge population to feed, but they've been turning themselves off to the American farmer. I mean, there are many reasons to buy reliable American soybeans, meats, grains, whatever types of agricultural goods. And because China needs that food security, America, I think, should use that as leverage to make sure that its needs are supported by American farm families. So completely flip the script to make China more dependent on us than what China is doing to other nations.
Michael, you follow this very closely. We hear all kinds of information on all sides of this issue as to the Chinese economy and as to how they are actually doing. From your perspective, what do you see as the state of their economy? I know a lot of times it's very limited information that we get, but I was kind of curious what your thoughts were about the state of the economy there.
You're exactly right. Whenever you hear any types of economic statistics or measures from China, you should always take it with a grain of salt, because first and foremost, nothing comes out of that country unless it's been, you know, approved and rubber stamped by the CCP. And they're obviously very much focused on, you know, putting out a certain image of their nation, and they won't let any bad information come out. However, there are certain fundamentals about their economy that are important to note, and one of which is that despite all their posturing about being against American interests, they are largely dependent on American investment and the American consumer, because we are still, of course, the largest country, you know, largest economy out there in the world. Additionally, another part of their economy is their leverage on what we call rare earth or critical minerals. These are minerals that are used in a lot of electronics. And so as the world becomes, you know, increasing its use on technology, that gives China an advantage to supply, you know, the materials and whatnot needed for technology. And so they might understand that that is, you know, not just commodities, but that gives them an advantage over defense systems, energy infrastructure, vehicles, electronics, any other types of advanced manufacturing. But it also just goes to show why Trump's response has to be about more domestic production of those rare earth minerals and then working with our allies to booster supply chains and put pressure on China not to weaponize that supply. Analysts have identified rare earths and critical minerals as one of the most central battles surrounding this Trump-Xi summit. And so no nation can be economically strong, you know, if its factories depend on minerals controlled by China. Trump's going to try to break that and weaken the economy that way and make it more reliable for the American economy.
Let's pivot, if you would, to conflict. Obviously, we know about this situation with Taiwan. China has one theory about what ought to happen. They ought to be much more under their control. Obviously, Taiwan views itself as a self-governing democratic island. And, you know, we have been making a series of pretty significant arms sales to China here most recently. Got to imagine that's got Xi Jinping and others a little nervous. Do you think that's something that's going to be bannered about here in these meetings and brought up as to trying to put pressure on President Trump to back off?
Absolutely. China wants influence over Taiwan. Trump should do what he can to make peace in that Taiwan Strait, but make it a condition of economic stability. Taiwan is not just a security issue. It's central, you know, to our conversation about, you know, semiconductor supply chain, those rare earth minerals that powers AI, cars, phones, and whatnot. China does want Washington to soften its position, but Trump's leverage is that any move against Taiwan is going to threaten global commerce and impose costs on their own economy. And I think there are some reports that were saying Taiwan and U.S. arms sales are, going to be among the most sensitive issues surrounding that summit. So protecting Taiwan is not only about, you know, democracy and deterrence, but it's also about protecting supply chains that really power American prosperity. And we can't let China think that they can bully us in backing off.
Let's move to the Middle East real quick. I have had a very difficult time trying to get my head around what it is that China is actually doing at the present time relative to Iran. It seems as though some of the messaging, I think, is more misdirection. And then some seems as though, you know, a little bit of an embrace, but a lot of confusing. I'm confused. And I don't know if you feel the same way, but I can't find a theme or a straight line of consciousness in how China is reacting to this Middle East conflict.
That's a fair point. And I think it goes back to the fact that the CCP, of course, wants to put out an image of strength, you know, to the rest of the world. And so if they see instability happening in the Middle East that is directly related to, let's say, you know, hurting American interests, you know, they're going to puff up their chest and you know, maybe even speak on egging it on. But economically, it's a different story. And it's why you're seeing, you know, the misalignment when it comes to messaging. I think China does want the Iran war contained, because obviously the war is, you know, is hurting its own energy interests. And Trump knows that. And I think he can even use that as leverage. China is really exposed to the energy market instability, and they have a strong interest in getting Iranian oil. And of course, what this war has done is created a global shock that really has damaged their growth. And so I think President Trump has an opportunity to make clear that, you know, China cannot seek economic calm with the United States if it's going to give hostile regimes more room to maneuver against American interests. If China wants stability, it cannot fuel instability against America.
Yeah, I guess we take the wait and see. There is I was very not surprised, but interesting to see how many major industry leaders are joining the Trump group to China. I guess that is a sign of for everyone to open up our economic relationships.
Yeah, I would agree. Trump is effectively saying America will trade, will negotiate, will keep the peace, but only from a position that protects American workers, American security, and American leadership.
Well, time will tell. I guess they start here shortly, right? He's landed there this morning, and I guess they're approaching some of the first meetings that they will have here shortly, and we'll find out exactly as they roll out some of the messaging as to what's actually happening.
Oh, no, that's exactly right. And I look forward to seeing that. Clearly, America wants peace and prosperity. But under President Trump, you know, China doesn't get to, you know, doesn't get to take advantage of us by doing that. So I look forward to seeing what they come out in this summit in the next few days.
Absolutely. Michael Austin, National Center for Public Policy Research and Professor of Economics at Washburn University in Topeka, Kansas. Michael, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate your time and your insight, and have a great week.
Thank you. You do the same.
Thank you, sir. We'll be right back. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers talk and text line. Stay with us. Folks, when we come back after the top of the hour news break, we'll visit with Michael Heck, President and CEO of G&O Inc. We'll talk about a number of different things, and we'll also speak with Jasmine Brown DeRussell,